in Buddhist countries, there's a chant that's often given, the Anicca Vata Sankara chant, Anicca Vata Sankara, which is, it's translated in English, all conditioned things are impermanent. Their nature is to arise and pass away. To live in harmony with this truth brings the highest happiness. This phrase is often said when someone passes away, just to remind us this is part of the nature of life, that everything that comes together, everything that's conditioned, because it comes together, will eventually fall away. And becomes a powerful reminder of the nature of impermanence. It's this deep truth of impermanence, which I thought would be very fitting to turn toward as we finish this month on wisdom. Now, during the meditation, I hope to give you a sense of this changing experience of impermanence. Because when we hear about the death of someone, there's a lot of grief that comes up with that. But impermanence is also permeates all aspects of our experience. It's a very direct, tangible thing that we can also notice too. Notice how the breath arises and it passes away. The sound arises and passes away. So as you practice learning to attend yourself to that changing phenomenon, so we don't become so focused on one aspect versus the other, but being in a place of balance that sees the rising and passing away, seeing them both very equally. It's the capacity of awareness itself to hold. It itself is outside of this arising and passing away. It's what things arise out of and pass away into. Learning to abide more and more into that state. So all things are impermanent. Their nature is to arise and pass away. To live in harmony with this truth brings the highest happiness. So as you look at that chant, that short series of phrases, you can almost see it as these three aspects. The first one is this clear seeing of impermanence, seeing it very deeply. Now when we lose someone that's dear to us, it's like it's right there. There's no denying. It's painful, there's grief. And perhaps it's a little harder to see, and just in the way that we tend to take the rest of life as being continuous. The sense of me, the sense of this body, as we reflect on how we were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, how our body has changed. The changing of seasons. And learning to connect with it in a very moment-by-moment experience, really noticing, really knowing that things are arising and passing away, feeling it in the body, feeling the reality in the body, the reality in thought, the sense of self, how that arises and passes away. In this way, wisdom starts to become permeated through ourselves. We start to know that as a truth that's not something we carry around as an idea, but something we know very deeply in our bones. There's a particular style of meditation, the Mahasi style. The style is basically just noting. You're just noting experience very clearly, very minutely. As you do that in the retreats over days and months, often what happens, the mind starts to naturally orient at some stages classically to the arising of a phenomenon, really seeing everything arising, everything's arising. And later on it changes perhaps to seeing the passing away, eventually seeing both as balance. And realizing this sense of who we are, this sense of identity, this sense of characteristics, our foibles, our things we're proud about, all this too is within flux. All this too is subject to impermanence. So as we start to do that, we see that the ground is not so solid. That perhaps as you open to that sense of things rising and passing away, your body passing away and arising, there's not a sense of place to land, a place to say, this is where I am. Right? So as we do that, there's maybe a sense of unease or disquiet. But as we relax in that process of change, we actually see it's very liberating. We find ourselves joining with the flow of life instead of always holding it at arm's length, trying to control, trying to change. So this is this direct seeing of impermanence, the first aspect of this phrase. The second one, we can see it as, and once we start to really see it as a direct experience, as a direct knowing, then there's the harmonizing with our lives, learning to start to see life as a process of change, to start to hold things a little lighter. I remember there's a story of a Zen master who said whenever he got a teacup or something, he would imagine it broken. Okay, so it would come to him, you know, a beautiful teacup, but he would imagine it as fragments. So then when it finally did break, he already had held it as falling apart. So it's often like if you get a new possession, a new car or a new whatever it might be, you know how tight it is, I don't want it to get scratched. Hold it with that sense of, okay, it's already scratched. It's already rust. It just hasn't fully manifested that with our own bodies, with our own experience. So we start to hold life in a lighter way. You know, there's a way of really appreciating things that are in our lives, but there's also a grace in allowing it to naturally pass away, naturally shift as its time will come. And this, another aspect of this, the third aspect, is once we start to fully see impermanence, really take that in, include ourselves with that, and we start to harmonize our life, start to live with that fact, we may start to find ourselves orienting even to a different aspect, orienting to what doesn't change, to what's outside impermanence. So all conditioned things are impermanent. So that which is not conditioned is unchanging. Is unchanging. And this is, many of us have experienced that sense of deep stillness, that sense of unwaveringness, that we can see something arise and pass away. But what is seeing, what is observing, is outside that change itself. It's outside of that process of change. And so we start to become more oriented. We start to see that's actually the true place of abiding, the true place of where we live. Because we also see that when we orient to what's changing, when we say, this is where I am, this is who I am, this is mine, me and I, that will create suffering. It arises and passes away. So we're always trying to find that place of unchanging externally. In the suttas, the Buddha, before he became the Buddha, he had this kind of epiphany. He realized, you know, here I am, a person who's always changing. You know, some days I wake up and my back hurts, and sometimes I'm happy, sometimes I'm sad. And I'm going out into the world trying to find happiness in a world that's always changing. So it's like trying to solve a mathematical formula with two variables, too many variables. It's like this is changing and this is changing. And in that seeing, he realized this is a hopeless process to try to find some point of stability in something that's always changing and the person itself is always changing. And it became one of the main intentions and seeds for his deep awakening, is to really understand what doesn't change, what is beyond this law of impermanence. So all conditioned things are impermanent. Their nature is to arise and pass away. To live in harmony with this truth brings the highest happiness. Now this first line, all conditioned things are impermanent. In Pali, anicca, vata, sankara. Now this word sankara, kind of one of the key words here, is I think we want to explore that a little bit, unpack that a little bit. Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote an article, this anicca, vata, sankara, discussing this word sankara. And he said, the word stands squarely at the heart of the Dhamma. And to trace its various strands of meaning is to get a glimpse into the Buddha's own vision of reality. The word sankara is derived from the pretext sam, meaning together, joining to the noun kara, doing or making. So sankaras are thus co-doings, things that act in concert with other things, or things that are made by a combination of other things. Translators have rendered the word in many different ways: formations, confections, activities, processes, forces, compounds, compositions, fabrications, determinations, synergies, constructions. All are clumsy attempts to capture the meaning of a concept for which we have no exact parallel. And thus all English renderings are bound to be imprecise. I myself use formations and volitional formations, aware that this choice is as defective as any other. That's, yeah, Bhikkhu Bodhi has a very humorous academic side to him. But this word sankara, so this co-joint joining, things which come together, this, so it's a process of verbs coming together, different forces coming together to make something, right? But the process of coming together means also that it can come apart, right? So this key phrase, all conditioned things are impermanent, all sankaras are impermanent. Now we can think of this sankara very much like our mental world, our thoughts, our ideas, our emotions, our reactivity, our likes and dislikes, and how we paint that over the whole world. We paint it over the possessions, our houses, our buildings, the loved ones, ourselves. And so this process of painting our reactivity, our emotionality, our history around it, this is all the part of the sankaras, including our actions based on that. And all this is impermanent. It is all subject to change. But think about how much energy you put into those things, how much effort, how much hopes you pin on something which is changing. Just like the Buddha realizing, putting my hopes on my happiness, on myself that's changing and the world that's changing, is destined to fail. So this, I like this, co-doings. They arise when the right combination of things come together. When things come together the right way, this certain experience arises, this certain building arises, this home, this relationship, this person, they all arise. But when those conditions no longer are there, then it starts to fade away. This constant changing, this constant flux, is a big source of our struggle, of our suffering, because we don't want it to be that way. We want it to be different, we want it to be constant, to be steady, something I can rely on. You know, things that we like, that we enjoy, we tend to focus on the arising of them, you know, the very beginning of something or the presence of it. That's what we really key on and try to manipulate life so that it keeps going that way. But there's a sense of noticing the arising of it, but if we're out of balance with it, it's really embedded with our sense of wanting, of kind of a tightness, a sense of agenda, of wanting this to stay. You know, I'll love you as long as you stay the way you are. There's conditions. And so much of our activity is really based on trying to maintain that, to try to keep it that way, to prevent change. When that ends, there's grief. It's often deep grief. See, the problem is when we relate to this changing milieu of life as being permanent, as being unchanging, yet it is. It's like building a sandcastle and expecting it to always stay. Right? We see that so obviously with the sandcastle, but even something like this building, if we look closely enough or with enough perspective, we would see that it's actually disintegrating. It's actually falling apart. As Bob Dylan said, he not busy being born is busy dying, and arising and passing away. So learning to shift from seeing life as nouns, as something fixed that we can say, this is the end of the story, to verbs. Seeing life as a process. It's as simple as that. Seeing a whole life as a process that's always unfolding, always changing. Right? Have you ever noticed that when you say, you know, I'm really good at this, and then someone criticizes you? You know, suddenly there's this tightness and this anger that comes up, because that sense of you suddenly has fallen away and has been replaced by a different sense of you. You know, when your body used to be able to do this, can't do the same activity. So seeing it as a change. Really what hooks this all together is a relationship to thought, to ideas. Because if you notice in the meditation, if you're able to go below the level of breath or of sound or of body sensation, then the impermanence is right there. It's very clear to see. But when we put thought over it, that allows us to kind of jump over, to kind of, it's almost like a magician's sleight of hand, a way of tricking us of the actual nature of change. You know, we fill in the blanks, connect the dots. That's why this relationship to thought is so fundamental as we practice, is learning how can we connect with our actual physical experience of the breath, of the body, learn how to disengage from thought, to actually learn to connect with the actual experience. What's the difference between my ideas and concept of something versus the actual experience of it? As we learn that very deeply, then it naturally starts to we start to expand that out to more and more subtle aspects of thought, of identity, of a sense of who I am. We see those too as just a thought. And we see instead life is really this process, this constantly moment by moment unfolding, arising and passing away. Now, you can get this impression that if you were spiritual enough, you wouldn't feel grief. When you lost a loved one, there'd be a sense of, okay, that's just the nature of life. Right? And that's, I think, actually an important misconception to clear up. So, you know, we're practicing the Buddhist tradition. So we can see the Buddha is one of the most spiritual people in this tradition. So he, at one point, lost his two chief disciples, his most long-term beloved, you know, his students, his people who had really attained the deepest parts of his of the path. And when they had died, he was standing, he was giving a talk in a room or a meadow of 500 monastics. And he said, even though there's all these people here, it feels empty. It feels like I'm all alone. It feels like the light has gone out of my world. So the grief touched the Buddha. So not to hold this teachings of impermanence as a way to kind of certainly not judge your grief, certainly not to suppress it, but to realize, okay, this is a power of when you care about something, you will feel the grief. What the practice does with grief is starts to transform it. Because grief, often there's a quality of, there can be a tendency to kind of start to fix, start to get tight around it. The practice starts to allow that to continue to flow through you. So it's like a wave of wind, of rain sweeping through your system. It may sweep for many months, years, but you're allowed to sweep through. You know, there's memories that come up, experiences, there's a loss of that. But you're allowed to flow through you, it doesn't stick. It doesn't get caught. So things that we like, Impermanence comes true to things we like, we struggle with that. We struggle with that fact. The things that we don't like, we also struggle with impermanence. We don't like the fact that this has arisen. We want it to get done quicker than its natural lifespan. And just a set of conditions have come together. And stepping back, okay, this is just how my body is right now. This is how my mind is. This is how my life is, having lost this loved one. And just relaxing into the process, allowing it to flow through. Now, impermanence, sometimes we take it as a philosophy, as a set of concepts, that okay, everything's changing, that's something I can just kind of use as a stance of life. But when we start to see that it applies to us equally, there's the expression of the body, there's the aging, but even the sense of identity, the sense of self, that is also not outside impermanence. In fact, it's a fundamental thing to explore with impermanence, to deeply see how impermanence also shows up in the sense of we, of me, of I, of mine. Like last week, we explored this I am not, this is not me, this is not myself. So we start to see that this sense of me is really not so solid. It's not unchanging. It actually is very much in flux. It's always arising and passing away. We don't often see the passing away. We just see, okay, here's this new arising, here's this next arising. And we identify with it, we say, this is who I am, and the next thing arises. But we don't see that's actually the flexing of up and down, coming together and coming apart. So starting to relate to yourself as this dynamic arising, this thing that's always in flux. So you start to take things less personally. There's a lightness that comes through. And as that deepens in us, we start to see that it transforms the sense of forming of self. You just see how that, it makes no sense. That's so far from the truth. Now, impermanence, I think we know it intellectually, but I think we also know it very deeply, too. I think we know it very much in ourselves. But we're constantly arguing with that fact. We're constantly trying to overcome it. If you ever watch yourself when you're sitting and practicing or you're going through life, how there's always this input of energy. You always have to kind of reaffirm yourself. You have to say, okay, what do I think about this? What do I feel about that? I'm mad about that. I'm sad about this. There's this constant energy input to maintain this sense of you. And that's because the sense of you is always falling away. It's like you have to keep shoveling coal on the boiler to keep the system going. It's like it's an unstable system that always requires this energy input. That's why you start to practice, you see that underneath all the noise, all the chatter, there's a level of slight extential, I can't say that word right now. of anxiety, of that sense of anxiety about existence, let's say it that way. And also a sense of out-of-controlness. It's like, when people talk about their anxiety, it's like, of course you're anxious. I mean, you can't control what you're going to think. You can't control who's going to be the next president. You can't control, there's so much stuff you can't control. In fact, if you look closely, you see there's almost nothing you can control other than the way that you're relating to what's arising. And when you start to see that, okay, that's where I should invest my energy, is how do I relate to what's arising? We first learn to have a kind attention, gentle attention, and that starts to transform more and more to a spacious attention that sees everything very equally, very much in balance. And again, thought, when we start to divest experience from thought, from our ideas of that experience, then impermanence starts to become very clearly seen. Now, as we rest in this changing nature of life, as we start to allow that to seep into our conscious selves, you know, I think before when I said we know it deeply, but we've forgotten that. We cover that up with our unconsciousness. It's like this kind of background driver of our lives that we're not aware of. This whole display of life is to try to negotiate this basic truth. But as we touch that basic truth, then we quiet down very naturally, without effort. Now, as we start to rest more and more in this unchanging quality, this changing nature, realizing things are always in flux, we start to see areas of fixity, of contraction in our lives. It's like if you're melting some butter or chocolate or oil or something, there's like a chunk that's solid in there, while everything else is turning liquid. So that solid part, that's the part of fixity where we identify something about ourselves. That's what we believe about ourselves. This is who I am. This is, as Eckhart Tolle would talk about, as the pain body, this kind of condensed area of discomfort, of identification, of pain, of emotionality, and of belief. Right? It takes the glue of thought and believing in the thought for that to work. Right? So we may see a lot of impermanence, but then there's this area of fixation. It's like, okay, I really believe that. And you may not notice it until the right conditions come up. You know, your spouse says something and it triggers you, or your boss says something and it triggers you. You know, then you see, okay, that's where that is. So this is where guarding against spiritual bypassing is so essential. Not to use the teachings of impermanence to jump over our pain, over our sense of discomfort, our places that were fixed. You know, for me, it's been very helpful to be very curious about those areas of fixity. Because we have such a tendency to want to avoid them, to turn away from them, to not see them. And learning how to be curious, to actually be, okay, let me just see what this is about. What does this actual expression mean? You know, what does it feel like in the body? What's the beliefs, the obvious ones and the unknown ones? There's just this last couple of weeks, just seeing in my own fixity, seeing it in a different light, seeing things that are a little shocking or a little embarrassing or a little surprising. And those seeing allow it to release more and more. There's often this, when things are stuck, there's often a deeper part that's not being seen. It's like trying to pull a tree out. And you might cut all the roots, but it's still not moving because there's a deep root that's not being seen. When you see that, then there's a release of that. It softens, it eases. One thing I appreciate about this tradition is that we don't hold things back. You know, from the very beginning of a beginning meditation class, we talk about how do you relate to your experience? You relate to it with a sense of compassion, a sense of kindness, and clear seeing. Those two qualities are all that it takes. You know, we have that sense of fixity comes up, that sense of identification. As that's being seen, all we have to do is learn to see it very clearly. See clearly and with a softness, without a judgment. And in that seeing, then it naturally starts to become more and more porous. Okay, so not getting tight around those tight areas, but to bring me even those with a sense of calmness, sense of openness. And when we talk about like this phrase here, all conditioned things are impermanent, Their nature is to rise and pass away. To live in harmony with this truth brings the highest happiness. So looking at that last part, because so much in our life, because we focus so much on things not changing, when we hold that truth in, it's kind of a downer. We kind of get a little heavy, we get a little sad. It's really, what they're pointing to is when we see things as in flux, always changing, really taking that in very deeply, it leads to the highest happiness. The highest happiness. Because on the one hand, when things fade away, there's the grief, there's the struggle around it. But on the other side of the picture, as we allow ourselves to participate in their rising and passing away, then we're also participating in their creativity of life, the unfolding of life, the aliveness of life. It's like we're liberating ourselves from our self-imposed prison. In a sense of who you take yourself to be, that sense of fixing, of wanting things to be a certain way, that's a prison that we live in. It defines how we talk, how we act, you know, what we can do and not do. You might see it with my daughter, who's 13, and you know, being in that age, very developmentally appropriate, but there's a great concern about what other people think about her, you know, how she acts and looks. And she gets embarrassed by my wife and I are less concerned with that, right? Because there's that loosening of that prison, loosening of things being a certain way. So this is really the enlivening part of impermanence. When we release our need to be a certain way. You see that if you travel, you know, you go to a different culture, suddenly there's a freedom to be different than you've been. Going to a new group of people, they don't know how you've always been. You can be someone completely different. In reality, you're always able to be something completely different. You can actually allow things to arise as they need to in the moment. And you can see the more we frame ourselves or kind of shape how we should be, that in itself is a prison. That in itself keeps us locked in a certain path. This is the sankharas. This is the momentum from our past history, our past conditioning, that we keep re-umping that. And as we release that, then there's a great freedom that comes from that. Freedom from that prison. The aliveness of change. All conditioned things are impermanent. Their nature is to arise and pass away. To live in harmony with this truth brings the highest happiness. So just to summarize, taking the teachings of impermanence not as an intellectual idea, but something that you see very directly. See it in small ways. See it in big ways. Let yourself really accommodate to this. Really see it in yourselves. Really know it's true. And then how do you harmonize with that? How do you allow your life to start to align with that? And then seeing what doesn't change, what is beyond change. And in that, there's the deep peace of the practice. So let's just sit quietly for a moment or two. And as we sit, see if the law of impermanence is wrong. What is not changing in this moment? What is not in flux? Is the body? The mind? sense of identity. Thinking. Is there anything in this moment that is outside of that law of impermanence, of change? Thank you for your kind attention. So just say a few words about the practice and reflection for this week. So this is just a way to, these are designed to help you integrate the talk subject into your daily life, to actually take it from something that you hear to actually how do you see it in your daily life? How do you see it in your practice? And so I would take this as a, it's presented as a challenge to you, you know, to notice this reality of impermanence in a direct, concrete way. Does any sensation, emotion, thought, sense of identity, or physical form exist outside of change? Does anything exist outside of change? So approach it like a scientist. You're trying to prove this wrong. Okay, you know, it seems like the body's kind of constant. Let's see if it, is it really in process of flux, always in change or not? You know, the sense of me seems like I remember what I did last week and what I'm going to do next week, I can guess. Is that something that's not changing? To really take that in and see, you know, for yourself, see what you see for yourself. And then reflect on the Anicca Vanta Sankara chant. That all think conditioned things are impermanent. Their nature is to arise and pass away. To live in harmony with this truth brings the highest happiness. So you might start your day with that, end the day with that. You may, before you meditate, or just going for a walk, kind of holding that. And if you like to chant, if you type in a Anicca Vanta Sankara, you'll find some people who can actually chanting it for you. Which might be very nice. So we have a chance for any comments or questions, anything like you'd like to explore. Yes, sir. Okay, so the comment is just reflecting, okay, what is there anything that is not changing? And the thought of the Dharma as being one of those things that doesn't change. But then holding what the Dalai Lama said, that if science contradicts the sacred scripture, we should release, you know, change the sacred scripture. So perhaps that means the Dharma itself is subject to change. Is that, yeah. I would kind of also look at the difference between, as Zen would say, the moon and the finger pointing toward the moon. You know, so the words, the ideas, the sacred scriptures, as your words say, or the suttas, they're all fingers pointing toward the moon. The moon itself is outside of our concepts and ideas. I'll say the concepts and ideas are always going to be in flux. Always going to be changing. You can look at a sutta, and depending, you know, if you, some people who are very who do this kind of thing, they can look at a sutta and look at the different translations and say, oh, that translation was from 100 years ago. This was from 50 years ago. This was a modern translation. So this is the sacred words really changing based on someone's interpretation of that. So the interpretations, the ideas, the finger pointing toward the moon are always subject to change. And certainly science, I think that is a lovely, important thing to bring in too, is, you know, how does science inform, you know, our practice? But what doesn't change? Because the Buddha actually did talk about the unconditioned or the deathless. And that was really the ultimate aim of the practice, is to discover that, to actually learn to abide in that deathless place, in that place of beyond change, beyond birth and death. Okay, so when you hear that, it's not so much the sense of never dying physically, but it's that moment by moment way that we take, something arises and we take birth around it. Literally, we are always being born to our experience. It's like something arises, we make a whole story around it, a sense of identity, based on our past or history, all those things. And eventually that will fade away. You know, we'll have another one come up. So that's part of the cycle of life and death from a moment to moment perspective. And yet, there's something that's beyond that change. And that's the state of awareness itself, to use the way that Rodney would define that, the sense of space in the room that holds all of us, regardless of our experience, our age, our color of skin, whatever it might be. It's the air holds us all equally. This is the quality of awareness that holds all things equally. And so too holds all of experience. And that in itself is unchanging. And so the challenge is to see that for yourself, to take it into a deep knowing of that unchanging quality. And so if something is changing, if you look closely, it's usually connected to thought, concept. It could be spiritual thoughts, it could be sacred thoughts, but it's still connected to thought. Does that help? At least fuel for more thoughts, more investigation. Yes. Okay, thank you. So the question is, with this view of wisdom, the rising and passing away of all phenomenon, how does that relate to social action, to you know, social justice? And it seems like it's almost incompatible or kind of a one or the other. Is that, yeah. And it's a very common concern, a common question that comes up. And really it's from the perspective of, this isn't perhaps the best analogy, but it's almost like on one side of the curtain, there's a whole logic of the world. There's a logic of me and mine and doing and not doing and stuff like that. The other side of it, there's, you know, it sees everything as empty. There's an inherent emptiness in it. And so often we're on the one side of the curtain in the world of concept and thought, and we're imagining on the other side and say, well, how do I solve my problems and the life's problems, how do I do that from that place? So it seems like it's completely incompatible, right? So the good news is once you go into the other side of the curtain, you see that it's completely, there's no problem, there's no question that it's an issue. It's what happens is that you still have a deep, in some ways, a much more clear expression of compassion and wisdom that naturally wants to go out into the world, naturally wants to go out and make a difference. But it's in some ways purified, because usually we're from that one side of the curtain, as we have that impulse, which is, you know, is this heart's impulse, there's also kind of a conditionality of it. Like if I spend my whole life working on this thing, I sure should see some change. If it doesn't change, then you know I'm going to get tighter and tighter about it. And you see that with yourself, very interpersonally. You see it with your loved ones that you try to change. And so from the other side, it's like there's this intentionality and this action, but there's also a release of the outcome. One teacher talked about it. It's like there's, how did she say it? It's like you act, but you release the need for the outcome to be a certain way. You know, so that's the emptiness coming in and informing it. You know, and so then you see, and what nice thing too is that you start to participate in life's the changing phenomenon. You see things are always in flux, right? In that state of flux, you're much more aligned with how life actually is. And because you're more aligned with it, your actions make more sense. You're actually more effective versus, you know, saying, okay, this is how it should be. That kind of hardness bumps up against other people's hardness on the other side of the issue. And so then you have this, you know, who's going to win? But if there's a state of, okay, I'm in flux, all right, and I'm seeing that you're in flux, there's a way that person can soften, or that side or that perspective can soften. So, you know, I see them as not incompatible at all. You know, just to give you a very concrete story, Sharon Salzberg was in, I think it was in India, you know, going on one of those carts, and went through an alleyway, and this drunk man tried to pull her off and assault her. And luckily they were able to beat him off, and she was telling her meditation teacher about it. And then teacher said, Sharon, you know, what you should have done is taken your umbrella with all the loving kindness in your heart, hit him over the head. Right? So, loving kindness and strong action. Yes, Peter. Okay, and let me just follow up with that question. So you're talking about consciousness as in the five aggregates? Okay, so the question is, how do you contrast consciousness, like as defined in the five aggregates, versus awareness, and in terms of changing and unchanging? Because awareness, as I was talking about, is this unchanging quality. You know, it's beyond change, while consciousness is subject to change. I think that's basically it, that consciousness, we have to be careful with the terms because consciousness is one of those terms that, like Krishnamurti used it a different way, and you know, some of the non-dual people use it in a certain way, so it has a different quality. From a strictly Buddhist standpoint, consciousness shows up like in the five aggregates, or also in the six sense bases, in a very technical way, that to hear a sound, there's the ear that hears it, there's a sense organ, but there's also the mechanism of hearing, and there's a consciousness that knows sound is here. It's like the actual hearing of it. So it's conditioned in that way. It's arising in response to some sense data. Sound, smell, hearing, you know, all the five plus thought for six. So that way it's very conditioned. If you don't have any sound arise, sound consciousness won't arise. And so you have to kind of look at it in a very technical way. That consciousness becomes part of the package that we take to be us, right? The five aggregates have consciousness, has vedana, has perception, volition, and also form. You know, so those we take those five, clump them together, and say, okay, this is who I am. You know, I'm hearing something, I'm seeing something. Okay, so it's all kind of really tied together. But we can start to tease those apart. We can see, okay, sound can arise without us having to take shape around it. That's why, like in that Bahira sutta, in the hearing there is only hearing, in the seeing there is only seeing. I think he's taking, the Buddha's taking the Bahira beyond the sense of the usual identification that arises. Consciousness arises, I'm hearing something, I am hearing it, right? To just that there's just the simple hearing going in without it forming a sense of identity, a sense of knowing of self. Yeah, why awareness itself, I'm pausing to think, is there kind of a Pali word for awareness? That's kind of a, that's part of Rodney's style, because he's beyond just Buddhist from a teaching perspective. But I think probably the closest is that quality of the unconditioned or the undying, the sense of knowing without it being having to be embedded in thought, embedded in identity. You're welcome. Yes, Sarah Lee. So the comment was that other traditions like Tibetan adds more talking about that condition and the state of awareness. And I would say that that's often, the Theravadin is the lineage of the elders. And these other traditions came in and kind of took that teaching and they kind of, you know, made it, fleshed it out or expanded it. So it can be helpful to look at that. So thank you. Anyone else have a comment or question? Yes. Yes. Yeah, so the comment, let's see if I can, there's a few pieces to that. But if I think the core of it was the body becomes, even it's this kind of interesting juxtaposition of being separate to change and impermanence, but also becomes this vehicle for really being outside of that. Yeah, and that's, the body is such a, it's such a reference point for, you know, as we go into our permanence, you know, really seeing the process of change in the body, you know, feeling the hand and feeling the outline of the body. It's just this constant pressures and warmth and coolness. It's always in this quality of flux. So it really allows us to keep reminding us of impermanence. You know, and that you also talked about the quality of love, of metta. And I think you going back to the last question and comment, I would almost say that this quality of awareness is not talked about so directly in the Theravadin tradition, but at the same time, it's very much embedded into it. You know, there's many suttas, if you read it from the idea of emptiness and going back to the love, like there's the simile of the saw where the Buddha talks about metta. You know, metta is like being like the air that you could paint and the air is unaffected by that. You know, so the love is unaffected by what goes through it, what affects it. And that points really to this quality of deep awareness. Yeah, so, and then Susan, just that quality of that spaciousness, you know, trusting that, allowing yourself to follow that expression in yourself, however that shows up, you know, trusting not the words and the ideas, but trusting in the really the felt sense of that release. And for each of us, that shows up in a different way. And there's similarities, different qualities, but it's that, that felt sense is undeniable. When we really see it, we really experience it, that becomes our truest guide, more than the ideas and concepts. Thank you. Anyone else? Thank you for your attention.